Hi, Blogging Heads. It's Spencer Ackerman at the Washington Independent and Fire Dog Lake, here with my good friend Eli Lake of the Washington Times.
Hey, Spencer. How are you?
I'm well, Eli. How are you?
I'm all right.
I was hoping we could take this opportunity, given that in a couple hours, Barack Obama is going to have an audience with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to discuss Iraq in general, where what's now being called the Forgotten War stands in the American political and cultural landscape. And because, you know, people who write about Iraq and foreign policy in general don't really do this often, Eli and I are going to talk to you candidly and with introspection about what we got wrong about Iraq as well as some of what we got right. So first off, my question, Eli, how much attention do you think Iraq is getting from the Obama administration versus what it deserves to get?
I'm going to zag when everyone seems to be zigging on this, because I think that when you put a vice president in charge of a policy, it shows that you obviously it's important. There's still more than 100,000 troops in Iraq, so it's obviously important to the military. So even if Obama does not publicly give it the attention of, say, healthcare reform or other kinds of initiatives in terms of kind of reform of the process for detentions and interrogations, It is de facto a priority, something that this government and this country is still very much involved in, and so I'm not of the view that I don't think he can afford to ignore it. Just there's too many resources already kind of invested and tied up into Iraq.
In the matrix of foreign policy considerations that the Obama administration has got to kind of put into the entire picture, where do you think Iraq stands as a priority? And again, versus, you know, not so much what he's doing with everything else domestically, but what amount of resources do you think the effort's getting versus what it deserves? That's expressed very badly, but I think you see what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the resources, I'm still trying to report out exactly what's going to happen to the detainees and Task Force 134. And there were some people that I think were like Laith Ghazali and the Erbil 5. And it's interesting to find out, well, what's going on behind that? Because if they were as dangerous as we were initially told these people were, then why are they being let free? Because they certainly would not fit into the category of reconcilables from the perspective of what the Anbar Awakening did in terms of bringing in people kind of with the choice of, well, we can kill you or you can completely reform.
Why don't you explain to people who won't be in the weeds on this what you're talking about?
Well, I mean, one of the tactics that worked very well in what's, for lack of a better word, called the surge, but what we call the sort of counterinsurgency strategy that began in the beginning of 2007 or end of 2006, was that terrorists who were seen as persuadable were given an option to join in sort of local governments at first and then later other kinds of institutions that were able to sort of get them to disarm and join the fight against what were seen as a hardcore. In the case of Anbar, that would be al-Qaeda. In the case of the Shia extremists, that would be something called the special groups. So, it was a strategy that was aimed at kind of winning over as many people as you could, even if they had done terrible things in the past during the war. And someone like Laith Ghazali, or for that matter, the Quds Force members from the Erbil 5, were said for a very long time during this process to be part of the sort of really hardcore that were very dangerous and could not be persuaded. And so for the fact that they're being released, raises questions as to what's happening with that, but I'm not in a position yet, Spencer, to sort of make a judgment. My editor Barbara Slavin had a very interesting story last week and a follow up I think in the paper today on how certain people told her, and I think in the story today we have Ryan Crocker on the record saying that there was no specific evidence on the Erbil 5. So we're still sort of trying to get to the bottom of it. My sense, though, is that the people who were senior members of the Quds Force were dangerous, and to let them free means that they would be able to sort of continue to make mayhem.
What seems like is kind of in the background on those series of questions is the emergence of the Iraqi government as, I think at this point, there's consensus within the Obama administration on, not just a sovereign entity, but a robust sovereign entity. And that's going to be something that Maliki, I understand, will be stressing to Obama and when he meets some of the American reporters tomorrow, as I understand both of us are are going to be part of that. We'll see and talk about. I mean, one of the issues, as I understand it, with the cohort of Quds Force detainees that you're talking about, is that their freedom ultimately gets set out under the discretion and the prerogative of the Iraqi government as part of the security agreement known as the SOFA that we signed with the Iraqis last year. So what do you think that, you know, we should really view the situation as from the perspective and through the prism of rising Iraqi sovereignty? I mean, one of the things that I've heard a lot of from people who work on Iraq in the Obama administration and people in the military who are dealing with the Iraqi government a lot is that, you know, we're coming to terms with the fact that, you know, we are going to, you know, have an Iraqi ally that sees itself as, you know, by necessity, by necessary, you know, political considerations and by fact of geography, as close to the Iranians, and they're going to have to make consideration, you know, deals and considerations based on that, and to some degree we just have to swallow it.
I mean, from the very beginning of the Iraq, since there was, before even a sovereign state, when there was an Iraqi governing council, there were very public public delegations led by people like Jalal Talabani and Ayad Alawi and others who went to Tehran and even signed agreements with the Iranians during the height of the Bush administration's rhetoric against the Iranians. And so there's always been, I think, that understanding that there, and of course, Maliki was a former member of Dawa, and Dawa was supported for years in exile by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, as well as Skiri, which became ISKI. Now, that all said, I think the events of about a year ago, or more than a year ago now, in the battle for Basra proved that that Maliki was willing to use force and violence against Iranian-supported special groups, and that, I think, showed that there was a level of independence. But there's another interesting element here, which is that throughout the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, the Iranians always had an ambassador in Baghdad. So the Iranians have never had a problem, at least this version of the regime, have never had a problem with killing you with one part of their government and then trying to negotiate with you another part of the government. So I would imagine that the Iraqis kind of view it in the same way, that, of course, there are elements in Iran and there are things that Iran does that are very, very troubling and damaging to the Iraqi state, and the prospect for Iraq to kind of move past this phase into and to continue to sort of accumulate its sovereignty. At the same time, they are an important neighbor. There's a lot of tourism that's going to be coming from Iranians visiting the Shia holy places in Najaf and Karbala, and they can't afford not to deal with the Iranians. So I think it's a wary relationship, but I think that also maybe goes both ways because, you know, the Ayatollah Sistani in Najaf is kind of a living refutation of the current clerisy in Iran in some ways, especially since Ayatollah Sistani supports elections and free elections, and clearly right now the supreme leader of Iran does not.
I understand there's also, and I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on this. We should get, you know, back out for people who, you know, aren't, you know, interested in getting so far down. But I understand there's actually a demonstration. If it's not still going on, it ended, you know, a few hours ago in Basra against the theft of the election in Iran. And it'll be interesting to see what sort of complication that will have on Iraqi-Iranian relations, which, you know, both countries say is very important to them. I want to talk briefly about, you know, one of the things that I never would have expected in Iraq, and I wonder about what you share this, which is why not just Iraq has diminished as a political issue, that's at least somewhat understandable, with the, you know, advent of first a security agreement and then a formal administration strategy for withdrawal, but as a cultural event, Iraq is, in the United States, you know, reached, you know, the kind of invisibility that, you know, we expected and that we saw, you know, in Afghanistan for you know, low these many years. And I was talking with a very interesting guy who I profiled for the Washington Independent on today, Wednesday morning, a guy named Doug Olivant, who's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, served in Iraq in some of the hairier places, in some of the hairiest times, Najaf, Baghdad, and Fallujah in 2004-05, became part of the Petraeus Brain Trust during the surge in Baghdad in 2007, and then became one of the directors for Iraq on the National Security Council, working in the last year of the Bush administration, the first year of the Obama administration. And I asked him about the kind of invisibility of the Iraq war you know, you said it's basically, you know, a combination of three factors. First, the massive diminution in security incidents in you know, danger and in the increased stability of Iraq post-surge in a way that basically no one ever, you know, anticipated or expected. You know, even the architects of the surge are pretty, you know, blunt about that. Second, the available policy options under the SOFA basically, converge and restrict in such a way that there isn't that much leeway for American policy to really change course, and that's, you know, diminished the ability of kind of all sides to, you know, stake out, you know, either further left or further right alternatives. We have a binding diplomatic board, and, you know, that allows for the third factor to kind of come into play easily politically, which is that the country just seems in general to be exhausted by the Iraq war. You know, I don't know if you saw The Hurt Locker, which is a really...
No, I've been intending to see that.
It's an excellent, you know, film, and I think, you know, for a lot of people, you know, veterans first and foremost, it'll be, you know, difficult to sit through. But I just, you know, I haven't, you know, done the research on this, but I just wonder what, you know, whether people are watching or not, whether it's got, you know, box office receipts or anything. But I just, you know, thought that those three points, you know, really went a long way towards explaining why Iraq has just been, you know, such a massive, you know, I'm sorry to put it in like press media terms, but basically non-store over the past several months. I'm wondering what you make of that.
I mean, it's clearly like it doesn't have the same domestic constituencies pushing for it to be a story. You had a perfect storm in terms of coverage of Iraq for a while, which was that you had an anti-war left that wanted media attention about it, and that there was a lot of stories about how they were their strategies to try to end the war. And then you had an exhausted conservative base that saw in the war the last thing that everybody could basically agree on, because there were deep divisions on the right about everything from the way that kind of Bush did compassionate service, big government conservatism versus, you know, there were social issues. You had a lot of libertarians on the right who were very uncomfortable with, you know, the evangelical approach to a lot of policy issues. And so there was great divisions among the Republican Party, and I think the one thing that conservatives could agree on was the war. And I think that there was, for Democrats, a revitalization politically here, in that talking about Iraq was a way to kind of get people out and to get people to care about politics. It was I think the Iraq war as a war brought in a lot of the Dean voters that eventually kind of became the network for Obama in some ways. So you had it, you know, when you have both sides agreeing that they want to have a fight, similar to like both Cheney and Axelrod and Obama want to have a fight about war on terror policies, I think the same thing was true with Iraq, and that's not true anymore, because now the Democrats have to govern, and it's hard to govern with, you can't govern in the slogans of the anti-war base, and now conservatives are kind of in the wilderness, and they need to come up with a much more coherent and plan for kind of sticking together and coming up with their governing platform. So the war does not serve those interests as much anymore.
Can I just go deeper on that one point for a bit? You had called the Iraq War the kind of centripetal force for the right for so long. Why did that lose its salience? Just because of the electoral defeat or what?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, Spencer, I think it's because in the end, Obama, you know, kind of, I don't think that the right ever really wanted a kind of indefinite occupation. What they wanted to say was that they were against a premature withdrawal. Well, Obama is not doing a premature withdrawal at this point. As we've all pointed out, or at least the empirical facts are now agreed upon, that Iraq is on a good is on a much better trajectory. So therefore, you need fewer troops there. So therefore, it's harder to kind of make the argument against what would be seen as sort of a disastrous policy at the time of a too premature withdrawal. So I think that on the right, you know, when you don't have a good enemy to argue with, it's hard to get people out. And I think that just like there was a centrifugal force bringing people to want to talk about Iraq, it's the same thing has happened in reverse, because I don't think that the anti-war side of the Democrats want to really pick a fight with Obama about, you know, what he's doing in Iraq right now. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. And I remember a couple, weeks or months ago, you and I were going to get a drink, and you asked me, you know, why did the anti-war left not demonstrate, you know, concern, you know, any kind of, you know, fervent or consistent argumentation against the prospect that, you know, at the end of the SOFA period, post-2011, there's going to be a relationship with Iraq that, you know, will, you know, have military aspects to it. It's not going to look anything like what it currently looks like now.
Yeah.
I have been kind of, you know, taken by how many, you know, military officers and high-level officials are willing to say, like, you know, on the record, you know, there will be no U.S. troops there, there will be ultimate withdrawal and so forth. But there's still nevertheless going to be a really broad-based relationship, you know, with Iraq, and that is going to have, you know, elements of, you know, it's going to have military components. It's, you know, we're going to be selling them lots of stuff. That means we, you know, keep spare parts coming. That means we have American technical expertise, you know, with the Iraqi Ministry of Defense, to, you know, showing them how to do with this stuff. I don't think there's anyone who, you know, studies these issues who really believes there's not going to be a robust intelligence relationship between the U.S. and myriad Iraqi intelligence services, and so on and so forth. And you ask me, you know, why, you know, the American left, you know, that was, you know, really reached a kind of point of political maturity over, you know, the course of the Bush administration over the Iraq war didn't have a problem with it. And it, at the time, I think I said something on the order of, like, there's an equilibrium that's been reached in terms of policy maturity. And I'm not really sure that that's true. I think, you know, probably the simpler explanation is, first, you know, the concern of you know, liberals and progressives right now is overwhelmingly domestic. Second, areas of acrimony over Iraq are, you know, subsumed by a kind of growing discontent over Afghanistan that's going to become more salient over the next several months. And then finally, you know, just the lack of coverage and visibility, you know, hasn't really brought this, you know, out into the blogosphere in a way that, you know, we saw really every single bit of, you know, relevant or potentially relevant, you know, policy substance on Iraq got, you know, poured over and debated and invective spewed upon and so forth. And, you know, it's just dropped so rapidly, you know, in the order of concern. And I think, you know, Doug Ollivan's point is still, you know, ultimately correct, that there isn't much, you know, policy-wise anyone can do on Iraq now that we're in a post-SOFA environment. And there's less that people want to do. It's become basically a stable way of keeping policy on a very even keel. You know, there is a lot on the order of how you stagger, you know, U.S. troop withdrawals that Obama, you know, deferred to General Odierno, the commander of U.S. troops there. And basically we're going to have, you know, something like 120,000 troops up until January. And then that's going to start, you know, dropping precipitously, you know, throughout 2010. And, you know, I still get, you know, and anyone else who's on, you know, the Pentagon's, you know, press list still gets, you know, the casualty totals of people who die in Iraq. And, you know, we're still seeing, you know, combat deaths, and we will, you know, probably after there are no more combat brigades or named, you know, U.S. forces, you know, taking part in combat, you know, after August 2010, which is the combat date withdrawal. But it seems like there's no appetite anymore for it, you know, for, you know, a country that just overwhelmingly took up so much U.S., you know, foreign policy focus and attention and domestic focus and attention. It still remains, you know, and I don't know if I have anything more profound to say about this, than it's just so overwhelmingly striking, even when considering, you know, the scale of everything else on the national agenda. And to some degree, when Maliki comes to, you know, the White House this afternoon, I wonder if it's going to be seen as a kind of non-event, or if it's going to be seen in the way so many other events are seen, as just a bit of a tick on the radar to say that Iraq is still here as an issue and then disappear. You know, probably the most, you know, sustained focus Iraq got after Obama's Camp Lejeune speech was from Stephen Colbert.
That's an interesting point. I mean, my sense of it is that there is a potential, I still think a strong potential, that you could see revisions to the SOFA. SOFAs are constantly being renegotiated, where you would see some sort of what's been called a tripwire presence of a kind of rump force, which would be much less than what we have now. But there are constituencies, and serious constituencies, in Iraq that are nervous if all of the American troops left in a serious way, that might be it might be envisioned by some of the rhetoric from Obama right now, and frankly, what is in the sofa right now, which is the end of the 2011.
We saw Kassim Daoud, who's a really important Shiite legislator, saying that the sofa should be amended to allow U.S. troops to stay in Iraq until 2020 to 2025.
I think you're going to see more of that.
This is a live current. It's not, you know, as simple as saying there is, you know, an anti-occupation constituency in Iraq, which is overwhelming. And we saw that when Maliki declared a national holiday, June 30, when U.S. troops, you know, left towns and cities. And we're going to see that, you know, accelerate steam as we get, you know, through to national elections early next year. At the same time, there are, particularly in the Ministry of Defense, more and more, you know, vocal commanders, you know, expressing, as you say, anxiety over, you know, what will actually happen when U.S. troops depart. At the same time, what we're also seeing from commanders, and you know, there have been a couple really interesting stories over the last week about this, particularly, I think Yoki Driesen wrote a good one in the Wall Street Journal either today or yesterday about how U.S. commanders in Iraq are finding when they're, you know, working out their typical rules of engagement, you know, in cases where they're supposed to go back into the cities for, you know, distinct supporting operations, the Iraqi troops, you know, at the discretion of local commanders, aren't letting them. And I wonder if that's going to be something of a mitigating factor, or whether Iraqis, you know, in their military structure, will see kind of, you know, a divide not exactly parallel to what we see in you know, U.S. forces, where, you know, local commanders are, you know, have different degrees of patience with Iraqis than do, you know, colonels and generals and so forth. But, you know, we still have this mixed picture of U.S. tolerance tolerance for the U.S., you know, showing a fairly, you know, large discrepancy between high-level political and military figures as to, you know, versus the Iraqis on the street. And I wonder if that's going to be, you know, something that, you know, any kind of follow-on agreement, you know, for the SOFA, you know, will recognize or envision. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I wonder if you've heard anything about this. You know, whenever I've asked if there are any kind of revisions to the SOFA, if anyone's going to open it back up, you know, everyone on the U.S. side has said absolutely not. That, you know, if anyone would be... You got the opposite?
I've got the opposite.
Do they think the Iraqis will open it back up?
Well, I just think that there's you have Kurds and the national Sunni politicians who are affiliated with Anbar, who I think are the kind of going to are more and more becoming the dominant strain or sort of the coalition maker, that they would like a longer term presence, but the presence that they want is not what you had during the surge, which is the kind of U.S. You know, U.S. teams at like every corner. You know, that's nobody wants that. I think that the symbol of a green zone, which is walled off from the rest of Baghdad, we've both been to Baghdad.
Yeah.
Anyone who's been to Baghdad, it's such it's like to have something like that in the middle of your capital, in the same grounds that Saddam's you know, palaces were. That is also something that is going to end, and I think that those things are going to be very important in sort of showing the Iraqi people that there really is a huge difference, and that version of the occupation is over. But yet, at the same time, I think that there is a sense that the Americans are honest brokers in the internecine disputes of Iraq, and it would be good to have some contingent of Americans there, particularly, I mean, we'll see what happens in Iran, but there's also a sense that I think even the Shia parties that used to be close to the Iranians don't want to kind of leave the field open for the – they don't want to become a vassal to Iran. I don't think that's going to happen, by the way, but I think that there are a lot of reasons why behind the scenes the Iraqis might want quiet presence of U.S. troops that are out of the way, that are there as a kind of safety valve, but to end a lot of the kind of a lot of what we associate now with the occupation or the I don't want to call it the occupation, but the American presence in Iraq. So in that respect, I think that there could be room. But we have a little bit of time left, but I'd love to let's do the right and wrong, what we got as journalists.
Okay.
We've been covering it from the very beginning. I remember Iraqed, at TNR. And
yeah.
I've been writing about this since probably I was at the Forward, and then I was at the UPI, and then I was at the Sun, and I've written a lot about it for the New Republic, and over the years, the Weekly Standard, and other places. So we have covered this war from start to finish, it seems.
I mean, I don't want to come across like, you know, as journalists, you know, we've had the most experience with it, you know, even in our field we have.
Right.
You know, clearly none of us can perceive the Iraq war in the way that American veterans have,
sure.
in the way that Iraqi civilians have.
True.
At the same time, I think it's, you know, I'll just be honest and speak for myself, you know, this war was a, you know, big event, you know, for me personally, and I felt, you know, very affected by it in, you know, myriad ways, and, you know, I wonder if you know, you did too. You know, the two of us, you know, our friendship in many ways is
based
on
the war.
To some degree a derivative of the Iraq war and the Iraq debate.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'd like to get into more kind of, like, I thought about this, we talked about this last night, what you know, it's more interesting to sort of say what you got wrong, and what I think here's what if I could say I got one thing wrong, and viewers, you know, I'll try to link to it, but the TNR site, you can't get any archives. But I don't, like, you know, I did...
Yes, that's a real problem, by the way.
Right, but I did write a piece before the war that was fairly prominent, featured on the cover of the New Republic, saying there was a huge disagreement about intelligence on Saddam and Iraq, and while we're not going to debate that today, Spencer, but we can go back on that. I'm not going to make the typical kind of mea culpa, and I'm not doing that, but this is what I would say I got wrong, and it's in two categories. One is, I did not anticipate that as an advanced democracy in an internet communication era, we could not sustain a long drawn out occupation politically at home. It's just that the old rules of warfare for a country like ours, it doesn't really matter. Because at a certain point, I think that when the public sort of turns on something, they need to know when it's going to go and end. And interestingly enough, the political fight ended up kind of, as we were talking about before, dissipating in ways that we both maybe wouldn't have, you know, anticipated. But the one thing I think was wrong, that I got wrong, was the sense that, you know, that there would be this sort of sustained popular support for the war, which I think really ebbed after Abu Ghraib. So that's the one thing, and I think that is a lesson in the future, because there's just never going to be an invasion of this scale of another country like this again, because I don't think that even us, let alone Europe and our allies, can sustain this kind of operation, given there's so many opportunities with, you know, cell phone cameras and other things to show, right or wrong, that, you know, our volunteer military... See, I thought because we had a volunteer military that we could do it, not a draft.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't even do it with a volunteer military, because there's too many opportunities to portray that military, and I think often and sometimes wrong. Like, I think Haditha, the original reporting on that, was wrong. But it has such an effect at home politically that it's very, very difficult to just invade countries and do regime change in that way. So that is a sort of area that I did not anticipate. The other thing is, I guess I wish that before 2003, I think a lot of reporters wish that we'd paid more attention to the logistics of what it would entail to, you know, pick a government. I tried doing some of this on the political side, but some of the nuts and bolts of it would have been better, you know, to have covered that early.
What do you mean covered? I didn't quite.
Like, for
that.
Example, like, you know, there were reports that sort of said, this is what you're going to need for a long-term occupation. You know, the public reports from, like, I guess...
Oh, you don't mean military logistics. You mean what's, you know, in terms of, like, all aspects of national power, as the cliche goes.
Right, no, I'm just saying that it would have been nice to figure out before the war. There was a lot of work that was done, not just by me, but other reporters, and, like, you know, the Iraqi army and the Special Republican Guard. But actually, the real thing that would have been good to cover before the war would have been, how prepared is the U.S. military to occupy a country of 27 million people in the middle of the Middle East? How many translators do we have? How many, you know what I'm saying? All these things like that, I think was, you know, that would have been a good thing to cover in that way. So I guess I would say those two things I got wrong, or I sort of learned that in the future, if there's some other war, I'm certainly going to be calling up the people who know a thing or two about peacetime occupation, and just in general, kind of all those elements of national power, realistically, what are our capabilities, what can we do, instead of sort of an assumption that I certainly had, I think, in the early aughts, the early 2000s, that there was, you know, I never thought that America was omnipotent, but that there was, you know, that we had more ability and more capability in this. And we kind of had to learn along the way. When Petraeus goes into exile in Leavenworth, he comes up with a counterinsurgency strategy. But it would have been nice to, you know what I mean? It would have been nice to have figured some of that out as, in the press beforehand.
What about bigger picture issues? I mean, like, I don't want to make this, you know, some kind of, you know, painstaking mea culpa. So why don't I go first?
All right, okay.
I mean, for starters, you know, it's no secret, you know, to use George Bush's, you know, phrase, when I was young and irresponsible, and I backed the Iraq War. And, you know, years of painful experience, you know, demonstrated that that was not the right thing to do. And we've had this debate, you know, and we will continue to. And, you know, to some degree, I think it's very healthy to continue to have this debate,
sure,
you know, on its principles. So that's, you know, first of all, from a very big picture perspective, one thing that I wrote about a lot from 2003 to 2005 that I think was right then, and I should have paid more attention to the implications of it after, was that a very, very dangerous thing for the American project in Iraq was a shift that transferred from when anger at the occupation ceased being a centripetal force in and among Iraqis. And I remember writing a post in 2004 called, you know, based on some IRI polling data that was headlined, "They hate us, but not each other." And that's a good thing. Meaning the worst case would be when Iraqis thought that they had more to gain fighting each other than they did in opposing the United States, because then the U.S. could come up with, you know, and, you know, fairly inventive if painful solution by saying, like, you know, why don't you just vote us out of the country and we'll, you know, go in on you know, we'll exit on a certain timetable and, you know, we can demonstrate that, you know, democracy and not insurgency got us out of Iraq, and that would have a salutary benefit, or at least that's what the thesis was of a piece that I wrote a long time ago. And as 2005, you know, gave way to 2006, basically that move happened. And, you know, when the Iraqi Civil War, you know, really broke out in full force, what I failed to appreciate was that the U.S. was no longer, you know, the main factor and the main causal consideration for Iraqis. It was, you know, what Petraeus would end up testifying is this multivariate struggle for power occurring across, you know, both political and military fields. And what I should have done was realize that the implications of that were that the United States had actually more room to act as a broker between the different factions. And that became the chief political insight underlying the surge, that different military elements and, to a lesser degree, diplomatic elements in the in the U.S. presence in Iraq could end up mediating certain feuds and could end up acting as interlocutors between the Sons of Iraq and the Awakening Council and the government. At the time, I thought that there was absolutely no chance that expanding what looked like, mostly Sunni, which is to say sectarian, militias could have any kind of salutary benefit. You know, there was I wrote a lot for the American Prospect about this in 2006 and a lot in 2007 about how, you know, basically blessing militias and paying them would be an, you know, innovative short-term solution that would have really, really awful, you know, consequences down the run. And I think, you know, while that's probably still the case in theory, you know, Odierno and the rest of the U.S. military has really disproven the idea that, you know, as soon as you get them off the U.S. payroll, they're going to go back to insurgency. And I should have appreciated that. I should have understood that when, you know, there really is this, you know, war between, you know, factions in Iraq, you know, the U.S., you know, it really means a lot for the U.S. no longer to be a player in that, or for the U.S. to have less of an influencing factor in that. So I was sort of, you know, analyzing this, you know, in 2005 and 2006 and all through 2007, in a lens that just wasn't appropriate anymore, or that didn't capture the complexity of what was happening in Iraq. And to some degree, I think, you know, this is probably the case for every American observer of Iraq. Like, you kind of get trapped in a really seminal period for yourself, and that creates a kind of, you know, Schrodinger's cat phenomenon. Like, what you're actually looking at is a view that you harbor about what Iraq and its relationship to American power should look like versus what it does. And I think, you know, left, right, whatever, no one's really immune from that. And so, like, that's basically also a really long way of saying, you know, I had a pretty, you know, solid 100% conviction that there was just no way this sort of, you know, could work. And politically, you know, we still see, you know, problems and hiccups and, you know, really entrenched political divisions, but they're no longer sectarian divisions. And, or at least we're starting to see the ways in which they can no longer be sectarian divisions. And, you know, ever since, you know, July 22nd, the alliance that, you know, started to emerge between, you know, 2008, different political, you know, factions across sectarian lines, and especially after the provincial elections in Iraq earlier this year, we're seeing the beginnings of post-sectarian politics. And, you know, I went further than that and thought that, you know, because of this, this meant that tactically the surge would have no effect. And, like, that was just, you know, completely disproven by events. And if I had, you know, been willing to take more of an open mind, I wouldn't have, you know, jumped to that conclusion so rapidly that, you know, by 2006, this really was, you know, I think strategically, you know, my advice, you know, had always been, you know, at least since 2005, but definitely through 2006, and certainly around the time the surge was being conceived, was that, you know, this effort had to be based on extraction and then mitigation of effort. And I didn't appreciate the degree to which the surge really was that strategy. And so I guess, like, you know, if that's not too, you know, much of an overview, and I hope it's not too much of a dodge, you know, I think those are some pretty serious areas where I got this wrong.
I'm excluding you from this criticism here, but there were certain people who I think never appreciated that there were groups and entities fighting in Iraq that were interested in a kind of perpetual war, like Al-Qaeda, and then there were groups that, you know, could, you know, that their concerns were, could be mitigated, which is to say that when you removed, I think the success of the surge had a lot to do with the fact that the terrorist Iranian and terrorist Al-Qaeda networks were eliminated and rolled up, and that there was a fairly dirty and nasty war fought by INIS, the Iraqi National Intelligence Service, the Sunni service in part, and with the American Special Forces. We still don't know. We still haven't seen enough reporting, I think, and I'm trying to do more.
That's right. This is a part of the surge that really hasn't been.
Right. So I'm saying that there was an element of it. I mean, there was a lot of things, and I think you're right, but I remember really getting frustrated in the summer of 2007 after I'd gotten back from Iraq and had spent time with some of the awakening sheikhs. And, you know, I was never under the illusion that these guys were necessarily modern Jeffersons, but there was I think there was a documentary that was done that was trying to show that, like, you know, Sheikh Ahmed Rishawi was like a modern-day Montebank, and that he, you know, was sort of a phony and didn't really have a constituency, and I didn't think it appreciated the sort of depravity of what it was like to live under Al-Qaeda in Anbar, and I remember actually kind of debating on Democracy Now, of all places, that guy who was, I'm going to forget his name right now, but I remember debating people on this and saying they weren't incapable at certain points of sort of showing that, well, you know, a lot of the followers of Sadr are not interested in a political compromise. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of people, and that there was a kind of, I thought a sort of way of equivocating in some ways and equating. There were some people who were using violence ultimately so you could have enough security, so you could have politics, and there were other people using violence to extinguish the prospect of politics. And we have politics in Iraq now because one side in that, even though they were disparate, certainly that those sides that were against politics lost out. But that said, I want to say something else, too, because I thought of it in what you were saying as another thing that I learned and a mistake. I don't want to say mistake, but something I think I've learned from the Iraq experience, which is that you need to make a distinction when you're talking about promoting democracy and encouraging democracy in transitions from places that lived under Saddam to now, which is that there's a distinction between having democracy and giving people a vote who have militias and are violent groups, and then I think that to a certain degree, it's not just – it's maybe the Bush experience, but don't make the mistake of thinking that you can allow armed organizations like Hamas to participate in a democratic process and necessarily get democratic outcomes. And you know, I didn't just learn this, but I think that that's an important lesson to remember. So maybe, I think it was a mistake, actually, to try to bring Sauder into the government in 2005, because the ministries that he controlled, he used to advance a pretty awful agenda.
One thing I think is also worth discussing, there's a project that I'm intending to write about at West Point, which, to the degree that they can, they're picking up on what Al-Qaeda considers its lessons learned from Iraq.
Yes.
Like, from what's going on.
I have a scoop coming out on that on the Iranian side at some point.
Ah, man, yeah. we should find a way to package these. And you know, I don't want to you know, give away, you know, too much of this, but it's been fascinating to see. And this was something that, you know, while you and I probably in late 2006 we agreed on really nearly nothing.
No, we were completely at odds in 2006. Yeah.
The one real exception to this was both of us were writing a lot starting in late 2006 about this movement that was coming out of Ramadi and expanding across Anbar, which really rejected Al-Qaeda in a place where, you know, and now it's, you know, now the awakening and you know, is famous. But, you know, what, you know, this demonstrated, and you know, I'm not saying that this ends up, you know, in any way, you know, redeeming the war or anything, but what, you know, ended up being proven for the, you know, for the first time in, you know, Al-Qaeda's brief history, in a sustained way, was that when you basically, you know, let Al-Qaeda have the run of a place, you know, it will end up, you know, acting, you know, just taking from its own perspective, in a manner even more counterproductive and even more like a brutal occupation than, you know, the worst mistake the United States could end up making. And what, you know, both of us, I think, started writing about really quickly was, if you take seriously, like, this nationalistic critique that says, you know, when, you know, acting in quite such a heavy-handed fashion, you know, a humiliated people will rise up against its occupier and reject it, you know, really thoroughly. You know, that applies all the more to Al-Qaeda than it does to us. And I remember both of us, like, trying to race out to Anbar as much as, you know, was possible around then. And I think, like, an assessment of you know, the Iraq experience in general, you know, because we're both Americans, is going to focus on the United States, but, you know, really has to focus on the degree to which, you know, whatever, you know, massive strategic mistakes the United States made in Iraq, you know, Al-Qaeda ended up making, you know, so many more and ended up demonstrating, you know, in a way that it's still trying to recover from, you know, as it expands, you know, into, you know, Yemen and into Somalia, you know, beyond Pakistan, that it's still trying to recover from, and it's still trying to demonstrate that it has, you know, more to offer a Muslim world that's now really seen, you know, not that any, you know, more than, you know, a marginal percentage, you know, were, you know, receptive to this message, you know, before Iraq, but, you know, really is, you know, demonstrated, you know, how overwhelmingly little, you know, it has to offer. And, you know, that will go a long way towards, you know, ultimately the date, you know, beyond which, you know, Al-Qaeda, you know, ends up outliving its usefulness and its utility and is no longer a threat to
I always thought, that the Anbar Awakening and the success of Iraq now is in some ways like a refutation of Al-Qaeda. And I mean, I'm so kind of optimistic, but nervously optimistic about the events in Iran, because at this point, the fact that Iraq has survived and, you know, if we can sort of see it continue on this trajectory is evidence that, you know, history is not on the – I mean, history, the sort of being on the right side of history is important to revolutionary movements, and I think it's important to Al-Qaeda, and they have just been refuted by history in some ways. And that's a really powerful thing, and I think – I'm very interested in reading this piece that you've got coming out, because – you know, for Al-Qaeda to sort of recognize what they did get wrong. And it'll be interesting if they try to come back into Iraq as the U.S. forces tamp down. I don't know. I don't have a firm opinion on that yet.
Well, so to bring it back to my piece today, I mean, among the things that, you know, Ollivant really stressed, you know, in his, you know, exit interview from the White House, was that basically, I mean, there are consequences to the fact that a civil war can end. And among them is that, you know, in this side, you know, I think the way that he would put it is, you know, a bit, you know, blunt for my taste. But, you know, he said, you know, there was a Sunni-Shiite civil war, and the Sunnis lost. And what they learn now is that, you know, they no longer possess a military advantage such that it can, you know, they can have a hope of changing Iraqi politics in their direction. And as a result, you know, a number of things follow. And among them is that there's no longer a prospect for violence to ratchet out of control, you know, barring certain circumstances that at least most political actors in Iraq are really actually cognizant of, in a way that the strategic picture changes. And, you know, one of the more astonishing things, you know, this year that I think everyone, you know, on the left was very worried about when it became clear that, you know, Obama was going to win and that the Obama people were extremely concerned about, is what would happen on the way out. Like, would it just be a series of, you know, relentlessly upticked, you know, violence? And, you know, basically U.S. forces withdrawing under fire and, you know, all of the dire scenarios, you know, we talked about all throughout the Bush years. And it turned out no. And I'm not saying that this is over. And, you know, if you know, any number of my friends who, you know, work on Iraq are watching this, that's not what I mean to say. And I don't mean to imply that the Iraq war is over. You know, these things don't, you know, really end as, you know, political phenomena. There's always going to be more stuff that happens. But, you know, if Olivan is right, we really have reached a point, you know, Nir Rosen wrote this in a piece for The National a couple months ago, that, you know, violence in Iraq, you know, occurs for localized grievances that have and will have political effects, but there is also a kind of strategic prophylactic to those effects, and that, you know, no one is looking inside, you know, even when we're, you know, seeing, you know, Marines, you know, getting killed in combat operations in Anbar, which, you know, for the last 18 months didn't look like, you know, would happen anymore, a situation in which we are going to, you know, find Iraq, you know, inflamed and out of control. And, you know, maybe, you know, this time next year, both of us will have to add this to something else that we misperceive. You know, that, you know, I do worry that, you know, even right now we're kind of frozen in a bit of a narrative. But, you know, and I will be the first to, you know, concede I'm no longer in the weeds on Iraq as I used to be. But I wonder if that really is the case, because, you know, the evidence seems stronger for that proposition than for its alternative.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder. I'm sort of on the big picture optimistic about Iraq. There are these things I think I started off saying that, you know, concern me a little bit. I mean, I'm worried about it if you were to get into the weeds. I don't think Maliki is a pawn of the Iranians. Do I think the Iranians have a lot of agents in the Shia parties, obviously. So that's a concern. I should say the IRGC has agents in the parties, and that could be a problem. But overall, you know, I think that there were massive mistakes that were made in failing to understand and how to come to terms with the insurgency early on in the war. I don't think that the U.S. was ready for what it needed to do. It didn't think it had a clear strategy for what it needed to do after the invasion, after it defeated the Iraqi military. And and that's been borne out by a lot of public documents and a lot of journalism, some of even from your two humble correspondents here. But that said, I can't bring myself to say that I regret the toppling of Saddam. I mean, I know that you wish that we'd never done it, but I just can't bring myself to say it. And having looked at Saddam, I think that Iraq is in a better place now than it was under his dictatorship. And maybe that's a good place to leave it.
Yeah. I don't think either of us, you know, want to relitigate the war. No good will really come of it. This is now increasingly an academic thing. I think that's a good place to end it. Hopefully the two of us have been intellectually
libraries,
honest.
Libraries, yeah, I think we've been intellectually honest. Yeah, it was good.
And so, you know, if we haven't, let us know in comments and so forth. So
let us know
thanks
in the comments.
A lot, Eli.
Thank you.
I'll talk to
you
later.
Bye-bye.